Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Boston Scientific SciMed, based in Minnesota since 1971. 3,000 employees dedicated to creating innovative technologies to treat heart disease.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanford. Here's the good news about the ongoing presidential election. Finally, the media is giving saturation coverage to a story that is worth the airtime. No dead princesses, no following a Bronco on the freeway, no stained blue dress. And here's more good news. You're watching, reading, and listening. So what does that say about the state of political coverage? Is the amount of coverage influencing how you want the election to end? How well is the coverage reflecting what the nation is thinking? Well, we'll take your calls on the media scorecard, but first we need to turn to Robert Lichter. He's president of the Center for Media and Public Affairs. He's also the author of What the People Want from the Press and Good Intentions Make Bad News, Why Americans Hate Campaign Journalism. Robert Lichter, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thanks very much.
Now, Americans hate campaign journalism. How do they feel about ongoing presidential election journalism?
Well, there was really great public disaffection with the media right after the election, certainly in great part because of the double missed call of Florida on election night. In fact, when the public was asked in a poll to grade the media like a school child, 20% of them flunked the media. I think the average GPA was a 1.9.
Uh-oh, so, you don't send that report card home.
No, and indeed, that was below where the public ranked the candidates, the pollsters, and even the much-reviled campaign consultants. So I think this story, ironically, the post-election election, came along just in time for the media to make up for some of the problems that they've caused with the public and with their reputation, that, as you suggest, there is finally a story worthy of all the coverage it is getting. And quite often, journalists will complain to critics of election news who say it's all horse race, you only see the candidates in brief sound bites, it's very negativistic, and we've done studies demonstrating this, and the public also believes this. All of a sudden, journalists tend to say, we don't give civics lessons, we're just reporting the news, but all of a sudden they are giving a civics lesson. I think they are giving a national civics lesson in explaining to the public what is going on. You can get a quick overview, you can hear blow by blow, you can become a sports fan rooting for one side and going through all the minutia, or you can just get a sense of what's happening at any point. So I think the coverage is really more informative and more in keeping with what journalists got into the profession in the first place for than it was during the election itself.
Well, now, it's interesting that you talk about how it's more informative. It's also something that Americans actually want to find. They want to know this stuff.
Yeah, people are actually following this story. Polls show high interest relative to...
I guess what I'm trying to get at is this a case of the Americans think that the media is doing a better job because this is a subject they've decided they're interested in, or is the media really doing a better job?
Well, I think the public does think the media is doing a better job, and my personal view as well as a member of the public and a media watcher is that they are doing a better job. This really lets us see the positive capacity of the 24-hour cable channels, which can give you both up-to-the-minute information on what's happening and the partisan debate. You know, you get the Nightline approach and the Crossfire approach. And for the broadcast networks, I think this is a rare opportunity for them to recoup some of their lost prestige as they have gradually given less and less time to momentous national events. And a best example recently was their cutting back on their coverage of the party conventions. And they've shown what they can do is to create a kind of national town meeting where people around the country watching the same news at the same time are bonded together and feeling a part of this national experience. That's something that that has been a unique function of network news, I think, ever since the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963, and a nation mourned through their television sets together. And I think now a nation is being informed about a momentous political process together through the television and also, of course, the print news.
Talk for a minute, though, about how this coverage could be having an impact on how people feel the election should end.
Well, there are two ways of looking at media coverage of major events. You know, one is to ask, are the journalists doing a good job or a bad job? And the other is to ask, what role do the media play? Just the very presence of media, regardless of whether journalists are doing a good job or doing the best they can. I think journalists are doing a pretty good job. But the other aspect of this is, of course, the election was fought through the media, and now, even after the vote was taken, the process is being determined through the media. That is to say, the spinning is going on. It's not purely a legal process or a counting process. It's a battle for public opinion. We can see a lot of what both parties and both candidates are putting out involves an effort to capture the moral high ground with the public. So the same sort of feedback loop that you get during the election, you're seeing again, that the candidates will pitch a certain line, the media will cover that, and then they'll cover criticism of it, then polls are taken, and the candidates then see how that line worked and whether they need to refine it. It's a little scary that that process is determining not just how people vote, but whether their votes count.
Well, but let's also talk about, for instance, I'm so glad you mentioned polls. Much has been made of a CNN poll, also an ABC Washington Post poll that shows that more and more Americans think Gore should concede. It's conceivable to understand, you know, you can certainly hear a critic in your mind's ear saying, well, of course people are saying that. That's all they've been hearing on that tape loop from the partisan debate that's been going on.
Well, I don't think that is all they've been hearing. That's all they've been hearing from the Republicans.
Let me rephrase it then.
Sure.
I would argue that there has been a suggestion of urgency, of the American people are impatient, intoned from some media sources that maybe wasn't necessarily rooted in reality. I mean, couldn't you make the argument that at least near the end of last week, American media were probably feeling more urgent about this than the public at large?
Now, that's always a chicken and egg question. You know, if a tree falls in the forest and there's not a microphone there to record it, you know, is it news? And I think there's just no way around this. The media have to report what various elites are saying, and there are some political elites, including some Democrats, who were saying this should not go on for too long. But I agree, there's always a problem. Journalists are trying to put an ear to the ground and find out what the public is thinking and reflect it back to them. But, of course, they're only talking to particular individuals and listening to the people that they trust, and they can reflect things back in a way that doesn't provide a true mirror of public opinion, but a prism that reflects the inside-the-beltway world of media and political elites. Now, I don't know if it's fair to say that they have contributed to the urgency. You know, a secondary mm-hmm. argument would be that the sheer volume of coverage has made people want it all to go away. but you know, then it's hard to say, well, you know, should you not cover this story should you not cover it as heavily, because if you do, you may affect the process. Well, then by not covering it, you affect the process. So my point is really there's no free lunch for the media. You know, you have impact whether you want to or not. And I think journalists are doing pretty well, but they can't avoid becoming a player in the process. I think they're being exposed as a major player in the process, regardless of their own desires, and that makes a lot of journalists very uncomfortable.
What is the saturation point for this coverage? When does America say, turn it off?
Well, I don't know. You know, you remember with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, it seemed like Americans were saying, turn it off for months and months, and it still kept coming. So, you know, journalists just wouldn't believe that people didn't want to hear any more about this. I think certainly that There are legal deadlines, Electoral College meeting in December, and I think those legal deadlines have become kind of psychological deadlines as well, as political leaders are saying, you know, this has to be wrapped up by mid-December at the latest, that if it starts to go beyond what people are expecting, that very expectation has created a psychological imperative. I think that by appealing to the Supreme Court, the Republicans actually changed audience expectations. They were trying to push people to think it's got to be over when the election's certified, and after that it's sour grapes. And now I think they have legitimized the notion that this is a little longer process and the courts need to weigh in. So I think the public is going to stay with this, certainly for another week or two, but I suspect after that you're going to see pretty strong movement in the polls that people will say, you know, get on with it, declare a winner, and go home.
We're talking to Robert Lichter. He's president of the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's the author of What the People Want from the Press and Good Intentions Make Bad News, Why Americans Hate Campaign Journalism. We're talking to him about the saturation coverage of the ongoing presidential election. What grade do you give it? Do you think that the press has somehow resurrected itself after the fiasco of election night with the coverage of the ongoing presidential election? It's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Jerry in St. Paul. Jerry, welcome to Mid-Morning. We'll try that again. Excuse me. There we go. Hey, Jerry, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you, Catherine. Mm-hmm. I think that you gave the clearest view of certainly what I feel about the press coverage. And I think these people are tired and they want to go home. They missed Thanksgiving, and so they're doing a rush to judgment in terms of how the American public is feeling. We want an election that's fair, and we don't care if it takes time. And I'm tired of the leading questions that they put in their polls. I'm tired of the fact that no one has really looked at the role of Jeb Bush in all of this. He knew his brother was running. You'd think that he'd want his electoral process or system above reproach. They're a banana republic as far as I'm concerned, and they're potentially affecting every American in the country. So I'll listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. We sort of strayed off the subject of the media there, but for what was there, Robert Lichter, any response?
Well, there's been a fair amount of criticism of Jeb Bush, even to the point of editorial cartoons showing him not being seated at the main family table during Thanksgiving, shunted off on a side table. And indeed, there have been, you know, to take this opportunity to open this up a little bit, we talked about the saturation news coverage. In terms of the information that comes out, one place that is suggesting, first, as this caller says, that Florida made a lot of mistakes, and secondly, that this is a mess we should get over with, is the talk shows, the late-night comedy shows. We've been tracking 40 jokes a night on Leno, Letterman, Conan, on Florida and the election process, about what jerks Florida voters are, about the foibles of both of the candidates. So there has been a lot of criticism, and I actually think that Jeb Bush has taken considerable criticism, although I think things are going on behind the scenes with Jeb Bush, with the Florida legislature, with both legal teams, with both sides trying to get demonstrators active. Some of this you just can't catch on the fly. I think mm-hmm. there will be retrospectives where we will know more later about how things worked. But you know, journalism is called the first rough draft of history, and it isn't going to be the full story or the polished draft immediately.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the evening talk shows and the jokes. Talk for a minute about how humor and comedy and stand-up comedians have become part of the media.
Yeah, this is quite a remarkable story. The latest polls show that nearly half of the American public say that they get some information about elections from shows like Leno and Letterman. And actually, I hate to tell you this, I neglected one finding from the poll that graded the media. The talk show hosts got higher grades than journalists from the general public. And I think the reason for that is, first, popular culture and news are really merging into a general information system. People go for entertainment and information and are making less of a distinction about the two. And that has turned talk show hosts like Oprah, for example, into interviewers, we saw this time around, and even Leno and Letterman, who now joke very frequently about political candidates. I think we've been tracking this for over a decade, and I think Bill Clinton just passed the 5,000 joke mark. I mean, we actually add up all of these jokes. But this time around, Leno and Letterman not only were telling jokes, they were actually doing interviews of the candidates. And the reason that the candidates are taking advantage of this venue of talk show hosts is, I think, that they feel it's very difficult for them to present themselves as full human beings in 7-second sound bites on the evening news, which is the average that we measured this fall. When George Bush went on David Letterman and actually took some tough questions on the death penalty and the environment, we calculated that he got more airtime in that one appearance than he had gotten through the entire month of October on all three network news broadcasts combined. So I think we have seen an expansion of the system of delivering information about elections from traditional media to entertainment media, and I think that trend is likely to continue.
Is it a good trend? How does it, I mean, what kind of impact does it have on decision-making, do you think?
Well, I like a lot of other Inside the Beltway old fogies, originally was appalled. You know, this really got started in 1992 when Bill Clinton was having a lot of trouble with scandal stories, Jennifer Flowers, smoking marijuana, charges of draft dodging in the New York primary, and he went on Phil Donahue to take his message away from the New York tabloids and the major media, and found that he did very well in that kind of venue, and people liked it. Then Ross Perot basically announced his race for the presidency on Larry King, and suddenly every candidate realized that there was something new here. As I say, at first I thought, oh my God, you know, Larry King and Phil Donahue, what are they doing in this business? But I think we have to say, first, it's the way of the world. It's going to happen. And second, it isn't all bad. I was actually pleasantly surprised by the degree to which, first, the candidates actually did develop some answers and made news on the talk shows, and secondly, the degree to which people who spend a lot of their time talking about Hollywood celebrities were actually trying to be more serious and to play a role. I think it's easy to say that entertainers shouldn't be journalists, but it's nice to know that if they're going to be, at least they try to act more like serious journalists.
Let's go to Ken in Maple Grove. Ken, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I have to just comment that I really think the media gets an average grade on all this coverage simply because I don't trust them. I think they're trying to make up for their mistake on election night of calling the election early. But one thing I do give them credit for is making Gore look a little condescending when he says, "In America, we count votes." To me, that makes him sound stupid. But overall, I wish that they would not have made that call so early and wasted a lot of our time. And quite frankly, I was disappointed because I was afraid I was going to have to listen to more campaign commercials. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, I think that that double miscall, could be argued, influenced the race in a way that helped both candidates. First, by calling Florida early while people were still voting in the Panhandle area, and viewers on the West Coast could see that all the key states that had been picked early, Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, seemed to be going for Gore. The Bush people, of course, were livid because that wasn't what their exit polls were saying. They were afraid it was going to influence voters in the western part of the country. Then, of course, when they, having retracted it once, when they blew it a second time, you could certainly argue that for all the long-term Republican distrust of the media for having a tilted playing field, Bush's father 8 years ago, you had the slogan, "Annoy the media, reelect Bush,"
mm-hmm.
which didn't work. But you could argue that it tilted the playing field in favor of Bush by making him seem like the president-elect presumptive. It seemed like it was his election to lose instead of seeing two candidates on equal footing, neither of whom was the putative winner or the winner presumptive. So I think you see this is an example of how a bias, not for Democrats or Republicans, but for ineptitude on that night, had an impact on the election and may have had an impact in both directions.
There's been a lot of talk. I know that CNN, for instance, has appointed a panel of three distinguished scholars and journalists to help them make sure this mistake doesn't happen again. Are other networks looking at something like that?
Yeah, they're certainly looking at this internally. A big problem is that they all tried to save money by not fielding their own polling teams and all pooling their resources into Voter News Service, one central agency that gave everybody the same information. And of course, what that means is if one network gets it wrong, everybody gets it wrong. You don't have the virtue of competition of, let's say, Fox making that an early call and then checking and seeing that ABC, CBS, and NBC were not following them and saying, gee, we better double-check our data. There was no independent check. So I think there's going to be a real question of whether we see Voter News Service coming back in 4 years. Certainly something that I think a lot of voters were surprised to discover is going to end, and that is the practice of calling states while voters in those states are still voting. I follow this stuff, and I was shocked. I just assumed that that the networks had a policy of not doing that. But in fact, their policy was simply that they would not call a state until most voters in the state had voted. And this is the sort of thing that really irritates the public, because it seems like you're doing something that could have an effect on the election, and the only reason you're doing it is for competitive reasons. That is, the early calls are done for the media and not for the public.
Let's go to Leah in Minneapolis. Leah, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Well, basically, without the media, I would know nothing about this election, and I find it very fascinating. I switched from the radio to the TV, of course, because of the live coverage of the court hearings. But what I found interesting, at the night of the election, NPR had Jeb Bush on. Apparently, they were at dinner in Texas, and he got a call and immediately dropped dinner and made all these phone calls and said he called the media in various uncontested states, plugging for his brother, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, well, how interesting, you know, Jesse, he's not a Jesse Ventura, that he has that kind of stature that he's calling all over the country. And the other thing is, when you reported that ballots were being smuggled out of supervisor office and another box of ballots appeared the next morning, we never heard again what happened with those situations. Also, Buchanan came on talk show next day and said, hey, those 3,500 votes were not mine. They
not Leah. Leah, this conversation today is centering on the media, and so what I'm trying to get from you is the media coverage helping? Is it influencing how you want this election to end?
No, basically it's influencing my day-to-day perception as to how it is progressing, and without that TV or newspaper or radio coverage, I would know nothing. As far as exit polls go, when they don't have a large rate of fallibility as far as exit polls go. And it provokes more thought in saying, well, if northern Florida was for Gore and southern Florida is more predominantly Democratic, what happened to the exit polls? I mean, what happened to the election in southern Florida?
Leah, I thank you for your call. We're going to go to Tiemann in Red Wing. Hey, Tiemann, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
First of all, I'd like to give the media a D-minus. Some concerns. Why hasn't the media given equal coverage to the activists in NAACP, Jesse Jackson, and the people who are in these counties who have given claims of illegal strong-arm tactics of the police, you know, setting up roadblocks, pulling people over? You know, these are basically the same tactics that have been used for a long time, ever since the beginning, when blacks and minorities were allowed to vote. I'm just concerned about this because you've not heard anything about this when there has been a grave amount of activism that has gone down there, and that's just been kind of, you know, hushed away by the media.
There's also, I believe, a lawsuit that was filed by Al Sharpton.
Correct. And not only that, there were hearings, I believe November the 11th, that were concerns with the NAACP. And the media has conveniently disregarded this as null and void, characterizing Jesse as some sporadic, you know, outcast. And this is, these are the same tactics. I believe, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it was only 1965 when blacks were allowed to vote.
Well, I don't know if I would put that date on it, but
okay,
I think I get what you're getting at. Team, and
1865
let's see.
Is
yeah, yeah.
Closer.
Robert Lichter, but talk for a minute about the point he's making, because I think you could make the argument that African Americans see this ongoing election through a very different prism, and that, in fact, the mainstream media perhaps is not paying as much attention to some of the activities Tiemann cited.
Yeah, it's a complicated question because, of course, African Americans overwhelmingly voted for Al Gore and, in general, are inclined toward the Democratic Party. So do you look at their claims of intimidation as a moral claim or as an exaggeration coming from partisans? And I raise that not as a rhetorical question, saying there's one obvious answer, but as a question that does have to be raised. And, you know, I was struck by the same thing, that immediately after the election, when it was clear that there was going to be a fight over Florida, Jesse Jackson staged demonstrations, got a lot of media attention, and then it did just seem to disappear. Now,
you know, speaking of disappearing, I need to disappear somewhere for just a moment, but I want to get back to this question. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We'll be right back with our conversation with Robert Lichter. However, first we're going to turn to Greta Cunningham. She's been standing by, waiting to give us the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
Thanks, Catherine, and good morning. Al Gore said this morning that he feels he has a 50-50 chance of winning the presidency in the courts. He says George W. Bush fears a statewide hand recount because it would wipe out the governor's 537-vote lead. But if Bush wins, Gore vows to help unify the country under his leadership. Gore spoke on NBC's Today Show. As lawyers for Al Gore and George W. Bush continue their legal maneuvers, thousands of ballots will also be on the move. A judge in Tallahassee yesterday accepted an offer to have 10,000 disputed ballots driven from Miami-Dade County to the state capitol by Friday, and similar arrangements are being made in Palm Beach County. A judge in the Netherlands has denied a defense motion for dismissal in the trial of a Libyan accused in the Lockerbie bombing. The judge says there was ample circumstantial evidence against both Libyan defendants. They're on trial for downing Pan Am Flight 103 in 1988. Israeli politicians are setting the stage for early elections in Israel. Representatives of Prime Minister Ehud Barak's political alignment and the opposition Likud party met briefly today to try to agree on a date for elections. They're discussing dates in May. In regional news, St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman leaves today on a 5-day fact-finding mission to Israel. Coleman and several other U.S. mayors plan to show support for Israeli mayors in the recent turmoil with Palestinians. The mayors will get a first-hand look at conditions in Israel. They will try to confirm Israeli claims that the country is safe to travel to despite the recent violence. Coleman is on the board of the U.S. Conference of Mayors and vice chairman of the conference's International Affairs Committee. Police in Fargo, North Dakota are reporting about 30 accidents from last night's snow and windstorm. The area got about 8 inches of snow, but it's been tapering off to flurries this morning. The forecast for Minnesota today has a snow advisory this morning for east central Minnesota from the Duluth area south to Pine City. Flurries are in the forecast today in the west and south. High temperatures today ranging from 25 in the northwest to 38 in the southeast. Checking conditions around the region, some light snow reported throughout most of the area. Rochester reports light snow in 30 degrees, the same in Duluth, light snow in 30. And in the Twin Cities, some scattered snow showers, a temperature of 32. That's a look at the latest news.
Financial support for our programming comes in part from the new and renewing members of Minnesota Public Radio.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include Cargill Incorporated, supporting Minnesota's tradition of community service, and Wells Fargo Foundation, Minnesota, on behalf of Wells Fargo Private Client Services.
Do you have a special toast, cheer, or blessing you'd like to share for the holidays? If so, we'd like to hear it, and listeners of all ages are invited to join in. We'll read select entries on the radio and post them on our website. Nationally known poets Deborah Keenan and Jim Moore will help judge this year's finals, and there are prizes for the top entries and special prizes for the best kids' entries. Send yours in 25 words or less by December 15th to Good Tidings, Minnesota Public Radio, 45 East 7th Street, St. Paul, 55101. Or submit it online at minnesotapublicradio.org.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. In the second half of Mid-Morning, we're going to talk about an issue that's a little closer to home. The Minnesota Grocers Association is going to approach the legislature and ask them to ease restrictions on the sale of wine in supermarkets. Wow. Think about that. You can go pick up dishwashing liquid and a good burgundy. Now, not everyone is happy with this idea. They think that this convenience could make it more convenient for underage drinkers to get their hands on a bottle of vino. We want to know what you think. That's all in the second half of Mid-Morning. Meanwhile, we're continuing our conversation with Robert Lichter. He's president of the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's the author of, among other tomes, Good Intentions Make Bad News, Why Americans Hate Campaign Journalism. We're talking to him about the journalism that's been committed in this ongoing election. Has it influenced how you want this election to end? What grade would you give the coverage of this never-ending, it seems, presidential election? It's 1-800-242-2828. Now, the lines are full right now, but just take down these numbers. You can hop on in a minute or so. 651-227-6000 if you're in the Twin Cities. 651-227-6000. Robert Lichter, I want to go back to that question of the African-American activists, the protests, the allegations that there was some sort of chicanery or intimidation going down in Florida. Why do you think that sort of fell from the front page?
I think there's no question that was a story, and suddenly it wasn't a story. I find it hard to imagine that the media are hushing this up for some reason. After all, neither Jesse Jackson nor Al Sharpton is a shrinking violet when it comes to attracting cameras. So my guess would be that there was a tactical decision made in, and this is a complete guess, but made in concert with the Gore people, that that was not the way they wanted to go, that was not the kind of strategy that they wanted to follow. I think they actually, I believe, influenced George Bush to change his initial above-the-fray what me worry, I'm the president strategy, and start really getting into the trenches and sending in Republican activists, because I think they were worried that there would be a national image of disenfranchised African Americans blaming the Republicans for stealing the election. That obviously is the kind of thing that that the Republicans have been working very hard to avoid ever since the South Carolina primary. But this is something, you know, you'd have to ask journalists. It just doesn't ring true to me that you would have a story as major as intimidation of minority voters that journalists would not be interested in that story.
Let's go to Dale in Minneapolis. Dale, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I have just more of a comment. And as far as grading the media on this whole thing, I think it's got to be pretty hard to give them a good grade, simply because the change over the past 15 or 20 years in the amount of media coverage that's available now, I can't imagine that there's enough true news to actually fill it with something of quality. And I guess that's more my comment than anything. There's just so much space to fill.
All right. Robert Lichter?
Well, and what's happened, of course, is it's one of those principles of the physics of news. You know, what is considered newsworthy expands to fill the amount of time of airtime of what is called news.
Uh-oh, are you going to work in vacuum here?
I'll try to avoid that.
It's just sort of depressing to think about news fitting the vacuum, but anyway.
Well, but just very quickly, we have at my center tracked the topical focus of the news, again, for over a decade, and the one topic that has just rocketed upward in coverage is coverage of crime, particularly celebrity crimes and tabloid-type crimes, so that there were more stories about crime in the 1990s than about any other topic, presidential elections, the economy, health, and so forth. And as we said at the outset, we finally have a story after saturation coverage of everyone from OJ to Elian Gonzalez, we tracked 20% more stories on the network news shows about this post-election mess than there were in a similar time period about Princess Di's death, JFK Jr.'s death, and the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And when you think about those as major, huge stories, and realize this is the alternative you're considering to saturation election news, maybe we should be glad with what we've got.
Talk for a minute. I mean, we're talking about how news has to expand to fill the vacuum, the larger news hole that's out there. It's one thing that's interesting to me. We've talked about how comedy has become part of the media now. Talk about the distinction between a reporter and a pundit. And because so much of this airtime is filled with punditry, what's a pundit?
I think a pundit is somebody with an advanced degree who stands in front of a television camera. That is to say, a talking head who is not a journalist.
You know, mm-hmm.
Essentially, journalists, or let's say mainstream journalism over the past generation, has moved from an emphasis on telling us what's happening to telling us why it's happening and what it means. Part of that is newspapers had to compete with television, which could beat them to the punch in telling you things that happened immediately. And now television is competing with the Internet, the web, in telling people what's happening immediately. So they tried to provide context and explanation. What that means is they get much more involved in commentary. To the degree that they are explaining, it becomes a more subjective process. And they try to avoid becoming simple commentators by distancing themselves and saying, we're the reporters, we'll bring on other people who have some sort of background in this, so that, you know, now you're getting on people who are experts in election law. We got used to all sorts of legal experts coming out during the OJ trial. And punditry is just the process of taking information and presenting it either as opinion or as explanation for the audience. And the more airtime you've got to fill, I mean, if you think about it, now you have three competing 24-hour news channels, MSNBC, Fox, and CNN, plus a lot of material on CNBC, plus headline news. You need faces and voices to fill that airtime. And so they've been rustling around in the bushes to find anybody who can speak a declarative English sentence and present background information to the audience. Sometimes that means you hear from people who can tell you something journalists can't. Other times it means you get a lot of blowhards on television. You have to decide which label applies to any particular individual as you see them.
We're going to go to Tim. He's calling us from Eagan. Tim, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. I'd like to hear both of your comment on the idea that maybe the media gets manipulated by one campaign or another, just in how they time an announcement. With all of our instantaneous coverage going on, when one camp is making an announcement, perhaps another decides at that time to release an announcement, and then the media's attention is drawn or split between the two. I'd love to hear both of you comment on that.
Sure. Well, if you'd like me to start, yeah, there's
absolutely.
No question. There's no question. That's part of the game now. Politicians know it. Journalists know it. Everybody has known for a long time. If you have bad news that you want to get out as a candidate or an elected official, you release it to the media on Friday evening, where it will fall into the void of the Saturday papers, where people are not going to notice it as much as they would. The people who worked very effectively on Bill Clinton's behalf during the Lewinsky scandal and the impeachment trial developed the technique of giving an exclusive to one news organization. If they had some bad news to get out, they'd talk to one news organization, knowing that the other news organizations then would give it less attention because they had been beat by the competition and they didn't want to admit it. So there's no question there's a kind of dance that goes on in politics, and particularly in elections, in which the media, the journalists, and the politicians are really stuck together as partners. It's like they're weaving across the dance floor, and each of them saying, you're leading, no, you're leading. And they're really leading each other, and it's just the way things work. There is an ongoing battle to control the news agenda between the politicians and the media. And I think in a very real sense, there is in America today, to understand politics, you have to understand there's the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the media party, which both the Republicans and the Democrats both need and loathe.
We're going to go to Jessica in St. Paul. Jessica, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just, we've been listening to the coverage on the internet, and as well as, on election night, we had NPR going in the background. We were on MSN.com watching the play-by-play, and I just wanted to commend the internet media. I really think it's come into its own as far as the election is concerned. Just wondering how you feel about that.
Good point. Robert Lichter?
Yeah, this is, of course, the new frontier. People are just getting used to the notion that that you can instantly pick up information from the internet about what has happened. It used to be that I felt well-informed because I could pick up the Washington Post every morning as my daily paper. Now I go on to the WashingtonPost.com site the night before to find out what news will be in tomorrow's paper, and of course, anybody in Minneapolis or Des Moines or Seattle can do the same thing. So it has had a great democratizing effect on information flow, as well as an accelerating effect. And the really frightening or exciting thing, or maybe the frightening and exciting thing, is this is still the infancy of the internet. As this caller suggests, we're just now beginning to actually have the internet function as a kind of ongoing C-SPAN, so you actually do see and hear and not simply read. And I think trying to predict the effect of this new medium on political and social life is really as futile at this point as trying to predict the effect of television on American life in 1950. If you think about the magnitude of how our lives changed because of television and how impossible it would have been to predict only a few years in, and think over the next generation the kind of impact the internet can have, it's really quite remarkable. I think the only thing we know about its future is that we just can't know yet.
We're talking to Robert Lichter. He's president of the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. We're talking to him about the press coverage of this ongoing presidential election. The lines are full right now, but take down the number. Maybe you can hop in on the conversation a minute or so from now. It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Robert Lichter, let's talk for a minute about the Supreme Court arguments that are going to be heard this Friday. The Supreme Court will not allow TV cameras into the courtroom. What decision do you think they should make on that?
Well, I'm probably one of 10 people in Washington who have reservations about cameras in the Supreme Court. Of course, the other 9 people are sitting on that court. And Justice Souter has said that cameras will come in over his dead body.
Well, that sounds pretty definite.
I think there's no question that there will not be cameras. The argument for cameras is perfectly obvious. The public right to know, the drama, the excitement, the creation of the town meeting that I talked about before.
Not to mention, many people suggested that the Florida Supreme Court gave the nation a great civics lesson.
Yeah, I do have to say that my reservations notwithstanding, I think that did work out very well, that you did see a very judicious proceeding. You did not see pandering to the cameras. Nonetheless, I have reservations about letting this particular camel's nose under the Supreme Court tent, just because there is such experience in both civil and criminal trials of influencing the proceedings. I actually did a study for the federal judiciary back in 1994 of an experiment in which they allowed cameras in federal courtrooms. I studied how the material was used, and the justices decided that the material, the sound bites, were being presented in an unrepresentative way. They felt it was more helping the media to write their to present their stories than it was actually informing the public, and they decided then not to continue the experiment. And about 6 months later, the O.J. case started, and very soon all of America saw how things could get completely out of hand as lawyers tried to become pundits and public figures and take their case to the public at large. And I think the danger here is, if you have a televised proceeding, instead of the lawyers simply trying to convince the justices, I think you will have the lawyers playing to the national audience, trying to affect public opinion with instantaneous polls being taken, and that feeding back into the process with the judges reading the polls the next day, and that possibly influencing their decision. So I think you've got a spectrum from the Florida Supreme Court televised decision, which I agree that was just a model of decorum on the one hand, and then the other end of the spectrum, the OJ trial. And I just feel that the potential downside, the risk that this can create a kind of carnival-like atmosphere and involve the media more in the Supreme Court's justices' decision-making, that's a greater downside than the advantage of having people being able to see and hear as it happens. I mean, clearly the public has a right to know. That's not the same as the right to see and hear as it happens.
Do you think that it's somewhat a conciliatory gesture that the Supreme Court is releasing an audio tape after the arguments?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're saying, look, we don't have anything to hide here. And I believe they're basically thinking along the same lines that I just suggested, that mm-hmm. You have a right to know everything that's happening. You can use this after it's happened. We're not going to make television stars out of anybody. You know, television is really unique, even with the web.
Scalia
now.
Tonight.
that's right, you know. And then we'll have David Boies, the lead lawyer for Gore, going on Letterman and joking about it. So you know, there really is a danger of turning courtrooms into one more vestibule of the celebrity culture.
Let's go to Thad in Cannon Falls. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Welcome. How are you guys doing this morning?
Okay.
Fine.
Good. My original point has already been made by a previous caller, so I'll get on to another one. I think I'm going to grade the mainstream media with an F as far as coverage on this election goes, due to the fact that I believe that they're a little bit more biased, and they lean a little bit more to the left. I'll give two quick examples. Number one, in the New York Senate race between Rick Lazio and Hillary Clinton, when Rick crossed the podium there to give Hillary a sheet of paper, you know, mainstream media the next day criticized Rick Lazio for invading Hillary's space. Well, the third debate between Bush and Gore walked up, you know, got real close to George Bush, looked like he was going to hit him, but you heard nothing of it, you know, the next day. Okay, and then Al Gore gets on TV, my second point. Al Gore gets on TV, says that every vote must count. You know, they want to count every vote, but you hear none of the mainstream media ask Al Gore, well, if every vote's supposed to count, what about the thousands of overseas ballots that have been thrown out?
Thad, yeah. Are you seriously trying to say that has never come up in conversation in the hours of saturation coverage between partisans and talking heads? And in fact, I mean, I'm just thinking of, for instance, just on this show alone, that point has been made. I can think
right.
of four times.
I'm saying mainstream media like NBC, ABC, CBS. I'm a news junkie.
Uh-huh.
I follow it very closely. And, you know, for the last week, 2 weeks, I haven't heard Sam Donaldson or Peter Jennings, none of these mainstream media interviewers
okay.
ask the question.
Well, not bad. Let's turn to Robert Lichter. He gives them an F.
Well, of course, the one problem in evaluating the media is people have their own perspectives and tend to be very sensitive to whether the opposite perspective comes up. You know, this is an old complaint, particularly from Republicans, although it came up with a lot of allies of Al Gore toward the end of the last election. They were charging a bias against Gore. There's a huge scholarly literature on this. During the election, from Labor Day to Election Day, my organization tracked every single soundbite on the big three evening news broadcasts, and we used social scientific techniques to categorize favorable and unfavorable judgments or evaluations of the two candidates. And we ended up, Gore had 40% favorable, 60% unfavorable. Bush had 37% favorable, 63% unfavorable. So that was pretty balanced. In previous elections, there have been arguments, 96, 92 We did the same studies, and Clinton did better than Gore or Bush Sr. This time around, both sides are angry at the media, and I think it's a reflection of the fact that they were equal opportunity debunkers.
Let's go to Jim in Minneapolis. Jim, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking my call. I enjoy your show. I've been listening to it religiously,
okay.
Especially the first few weeks. If anything, actually, I had to prepare a talk yesterday, and instead of writing down my affiliation, University of Minnesota, my students asked me, why did you say you were from the University of Florida? And I had to say, well, I had NPR on at the time, so I could guess. It was an actual subconscious thing. My question is whether the media is responding to their customers, whether they are reporting the stories or reporting the aspects that people want to hear, they want to discuss, or whether they are addressing the things that they want to talk about. The example that I was warned not to bring up was your show today. I enjoy your show tremendously, but it struck me that you were talking about what the media was doing. People were calling in wanting to talk about the election in general, and you know, I said, well, we're not talking about the election, we're talking about the media. And I understand that this is the theme of the show, but people, the media is not the story. It's the casing around the story. It's how the story gets transmitted. But is the media playing too large a role in this?
Well, that's a very good question, and we'll turn to Robert Lichter.
Well, first, this caller loses all credibility with me for not always thinking of himself as University of Minnesota first. Since I graduated from the University of Minnesota 30 years ago, I've been waiting all this time to get on Minnesota Public Radio to impress my old school friends. But
well, there you go.
But in fact, I think the reason for this show, I suspect, in your own thinking, is that the media do play a role. They are not simply a transmission belt. They are not simply a mirror of reality. It's a set of choices about what parts of reality to present that necessarily feeds back into the making of the new reality. It's what's called the Heisenberg principle in physics, that by observing the event, you affect the event. And we've already talked about how that the double missed call in Florida may have set the playing field and influenced the candidates' strategies for everything they've done since then.
Robert Lichter, I'm so sorry. We've reached the edge of our playing field. We're out of time. But we'll make sure we get you back here on Minnesota Public Radio. Robert Lichter is president of the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's the author of What the People Want from the Press and Good Intentions Make Bad News, Why Americans Hate Campaign Journalism. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, featuring the music of Haydn and Mendelssohn, and holiday selections by the men's a cappella ensemble Chanticleer. December 1st and 2nd at the Ordway. Tickets 651-291-11.